I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. In the first hour of today's show, a follow-up to Serial, with a look at the case against Adnan Syed, the young Maryland man serving a life sentence for murder, and the subject of the popular podcast series. Justin George, reporter of the Baltimore Sun, along with Chris Floor, one of Syed's original attorneys, join us for the first hour. Listeners who follow the podcast are invited to join us to share their views of the case. We'll also hear about an interesting play at Towson University set in World War II. Baltimore County librarian Paula Gallagher has three quick book reviews. And in the second hour of the show, weekend cooking plans that will provide busy people with good meals all week long. First, the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. Thank you again for joining us on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick and Hagerstown, WYPO, the Eastern Shore of Maryland and Ocean City, and streaming live online through WYPR.org. If you're listening online, we welcome you as well. You're welcome to give us a call in this segment of the show because we're going to be talking about Serial. We know lots of people followed the podcast about this case in Maryland, the case of the young Maryland man, Adnan Syed, who was convicted of a murder of his former girlfriend, sentenced to life in prison. And this story played out over several weeks, starting in October. As a podcast, millions of people have been following this. And this is the first opportunity we've had on Midday to talk about it. And what occasions this conversation is some news from the Court of Special Appeals of Maryland with regard to this case. So we're going to start there with that part of the story. Joining me in this hour of the show, Justin George, reporter for the Baltimore Sun, one of my colleagues from Calvert Street. Justin, nice to see you. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks, Dan.
And Chris Floor is with us. Chris Floor is a criminal defense attorney based in Anne Arundel County. He's a partner in Blackford and Floor. And he goes back with this case to 1999 when it first started. He was one of the original attorneys for the defendant, Adnan Syed. Chris Floor, welcome to Midday.
Thanks, Dan. Real pleasure to be here.
Let's start with the news that even though it was about a week ago that this was first reported, the Court of Special Appeals did what, Justin?
Well, Adnan Syed was convicted of murder in 2000 in the killing of his ex-girlfriend, Haman Lee. They were both Woodlawn High School students. In January 1999, he has appealed the case twice. Both times it was denied. That was challenged by his appeal attorney. And last Friday, the Court of Special Appeals essentially said, you know, we think that your arguments are valid. We want to hear more. We're going to reopen your appeal process. So essentially, his side will be filing formal briefings that they have to turn in by March. The Attorney General's office can contest that and file something by April. And in June, they'll probably have oral arguments before the court.
Chris Floor, how significant is this? And would you assume that the exposure given this case from Serial, the podcast series, got the court's attention and made maybe the chief judge of the court decide to hear the case again? What do you think?
It's interesting. I got to participate in a lovely panel that the students at University of Baltimore Law School put together last night. And
On this case.
And that topic came up. And Justin Brown, who's the current lead attorney in Adnan's case, who's done this work in the post-conviction phase of his case, stated unequivocally that he feels no, actually, the podcast did not impact the court's decision, that they've looked at this case in a way that they've judged it on the merits. But the first question that you asked, it's very significant that what gets confusing and what a lot of the folks that are following this case have thought, well, an appeal was granted, then Adnan must be going free. And that's not what happens, is that the Court of Special Appeals is a court that has the ability to grant an appeal or deny the ability to go into that court. So if they feel that there's a merit to the issues, they will hear the case. If not, they will say, just like the Supreme Court where you petition for cert, that you can't get into our court, you can't be heard. So this is a huge victory for Justin to be able to convince the court to hear the case, but there's miles to go still here because they still have to be able to convince the court now that they're in that they are in the right about the legal issues.
So the takeaway from what you just said is, despite the exposure given to it by Serial, they were fighting this case anyway. They were asking the court to open this anyway.
That's right. And Justin's been in the case for 5 years now, and he did the post-conviction hearing, which was done in the Baltimore City Circuit Court. A full hearing was had, and I guess we'll be getting to the issue of Asia McClain, who's one of the two major issues in the post-conviction proceeding. She did not testify, and the affidavit that was filed in the case has some pretty disturbing issues about why she didn't testify at that post-conviction hearing.
Right. Justin, let's go over that. Asia McClain, the name that Chris Floor just dropped.
Yeah, Asia McClain is a classmate of Adnan's and Hayes, and she wrote him two letters, actually, while he was sitting incarcerated, had been arrested, actually was just kind of being held in 1999, saying, hey, I saw you at the library. It's sort of strange that this is all happening to you. You know, she's just sort of saying, you know, I know that I saw you.
She presents as an alibi?
She does, and she presents as an alibi. But for whatever reason, Adnan's trial attorney did not call her as a witness and did not really investigate her or even speak to her at all. And nobody knows why. Christina Gutierrez unfortunately passed away in 2004 from a heart attack. But, you know, that was a big issue that was raised. Now, during the appeal process, you know, again, Asia McClain was sort of brought up as possible alibi, and I think the Syed's, you know, family friend and lawyer, Rabia Chowdhury, had sort of raised this issue again and gotten a sworn affidavit where, again, she's never wavered from the fact that she said that she saw Adnan in that library. However, during the appeal, she did not testify, and, you know, Chris could probably explain a little. She said that she was discouraged or dissuaded from testifying by the prosecutor, then Kevin Urich, because essentially that the evidence was too strong against Adnan and that, you know, I guess that it would not be worth it for her to testify.
Asia McClain says that.
She says that.
Hmm. Chris, let's go back to you then. Christina Gutierrez, I remember her quite well. She was a pretty well-regarded, very busy criminal defense attorney based in Baltimore City. And so what's going on here? The point they're making is for some reason, the defense counsel didn't call this possible alibi witness. Is that where the whole thing turns, this Court of Special Appeals case?
One of the two issues. So there's the Asia McClain issue, and then there's the plea issue, which I think is not gotten a whole lot of discussion, and I'd like us to get some time to talk about that as well. But on the issue of Tina and Asia McClain, a very, very common area in post-conviction proceedings, and very few of them get granted. This is not something where it's like the darling of the criminal defense bar that we file a post-conviction, then magically the case gets reopened. It's a very uncommon thing. It's very uncommon for the Court of Special Appeals to grant cert in one of these. But where it often goes is the first response from the other side is, well, did that lawyer use a strategic reason for it? And, you know, we've heard in cases across the country in the death penalty area in particular where someone will laughably argue, you know, like, well, he fell asleep at trial counsel table because it was strategic, you know, which is nonsense. And I think in this case, knowing Tina, and I knew her before I moved to New York, from New York here, I moved in 98, and just before this case happened, and she was known on the national scene, and I got to know her after I came into to the state, and I, along with Doug Colbert, who was the lead counsel in this case, and that I assisted, recommended that the family hire her because we felt so strongly about her. But no one now, in hindsight, really knew how bad things were going. And to know how wonderful a lawyer Tina was, to think and look at this letter, which I'm sitting, is right in front of me, that not only did this person reach out to him, but this wasn't like a best friend. I mean, she spells Adnan's name wrong in the first handwritten letter that she gave him, and then she puts in parentheses, hope I spelled it right.
You're speaking here of Asia McClain.
Asia McClain's letter. Mm-hmm. And what Justin just touched on, which is the affidavit that for folks that want to take a look at the pleadings that have been filed both by the Attorney General and by Justin Brown in this case, they're available on the Court of Special Appeals website, all of the pleadings and all of the orders. The affidavit from Asia McClain that goes into the claim that at the post-conviction hearing that the reason that she wrote the letters in the first place was that she was pressured by Adnan's family to write these is simply something that she says is categorically not true. And she goes into some other detail about her interaction with Mr. Urich.
I'm going to go back to Justin George for a moment here just to recap a little bit the evidence against Adnan Syed in this case. First of all, for those who didn't follow the podcast serial or haven't read about it in The Sun, in your coverage of it and Julie Sharper's, there was a first trial that ended in a mistrial. There was a second trial that lasted 6 weeks, and that's when he was convicted and sentenced to life. He's now in a prison in Western Maryland. What was the evidence against him in the death of Haemin Lee?
There was no physical evidence that linked him to the crime, nor was there an eyewitness who actually saw him commit the crime. What there was there an acquaintance of his, Jay Wilds, who testified that he had helped Adnan bury the body in Leakin Park. And Jay, along with some cell phone records, which have been contested lately, were basically the main evidence that sort of convicted him. There was nothing at the crime scene as far as where the body was buried. Nothing was really tested. So again, there's no sort of physical evidence that linked him to it, but based on that testimony that was the key of the conviction.
Chris Flohr, I want to go back to you, just if you recount for our listeners what your experience with Adnan Syed was. I know you were one of the attorneys at his original bail hearing, is that right?
That's right. There was, because it was a murder charge, the commissioner hearing was basically a nullity. The commissioner couldn't, under the law, set bail in this case. So after Adnan went through the commissioner hearing, he had his bail review hearing, which was at Wabash District Court. Judge Hargrove presided in front of that hearing, and Doug Colbert argued it. So I was there for that, and in preparation for that, and then preparation for the writ of habeas corpus, which we filed, I had a lot of opportunity to sit with Adnan and talk with him at the jail. Of course, he was never granted bail in this case, and one of the things that really we look back now and the work that Sarah has done and what she's uncovered, Sarah Koenig, in the Serial podcast, is that things were said at that hearing that the prosecutor later said that they will misinterpreted or misconstrued about some uncle that was going to make him disappear. And the importance, and looking back now, if those things were not said and the court did not have some things that were pretty darn inflammatory about the Muslim community and Adnan in particular, that would this have been a different outcome? And certainly that he lost a year of his life pretrial before he ever got through the two trials that he had.
Chris, we're going to take a break here, and Justin George and Chris Flohr will stay with us, and we'll take some phone calls from our listeners in just a moment. What brought you back to this case? Was it a phone call from Sarah Koenig at This American Life, or had you always been interested in Adnan Syed, even though you weren't his trial attorney?
What happened was I had written Adnan a letter years afterwards, because this is one of those cases that many cases come and go, many clients come and go, but this is one that sat with me, and particularly because I knew how Tina ended up and losing her license and being disbarred and consenting to the disbarment, which is just so out of character for the person that I knew. I was at Tina's funeral. I was that, you know, much dedicated to her. And I wrote that letter, and Sarah came across it when she was reviewing just reams of files, and I had basically asked Adnan if his defense team might have considered this one particular type of strategy, because it really bothered me that he was sitting in. I did believe then, and I do believe right now, as I sit here in your studio, that he is an innocent person sitting out in Cumberland with not just a life sentence. His sentence was life plus 30 years consecutive onto his life sentence.
410-662-8780 is a phone number for Midday. We invite your call. We ask for your opinion. If you listen to the Serial podcast, the whole series by Sarah Koenig and the folks at This American Life, and have an opinion about it or have a question about it, this is a good time to give us a ring. We have until about 12:40 to deal with this subject. 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance is 866-661-9309. You can also send a comment or question by email quickly to midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to Midday. In this first part of the Midday Friday show, a follow-up to Serial with a look at the case against Adnan Syed, the young Maryland man serving a life sentence for murder, and the subject of the popular podcast series Serial. Justin George is with me from the Baltimore Sun, and Chris Floor, one of Adnan Syed's original attorneys. Just to clear up a point, Christina or Tina Gutierrez, the late defense attorney, was disbarred. You did mention that, Chris Floor. It had nothing to do with this case, though, right?
What had happened was there's a number of complaints that came in from a number of different clients. I can't remember exactly how many came into bar counsel that that she was taking monies, and there was an allegation in this case that she had demanded $10,000 from the family to hire an expert that she didn't hire. And I'm not sure if Adnan's case figured into the bar counsel complaint, but I know that there was a number of them. And Tina's health was so bad at the time that she very uncharacteristically for her, you know, ways as a criminal defense lawyer and a fighter, did not mount a defense. She said that she was not able to mount a defense to this. Her health was so poor, and she consented to disbarment and died shortly thereafter. She was only 52 years old when she died.
Back to this case, then. Thank you for clearing that up, Chris. You think he's innocent. When you look at the evidence that was described by Justin George in brief there, because there wasn't a lot of, there was no physical evidence, right? So it's mostly circumstantial. And the testimony of Jay Wilds, who said that he helped bury Heyman Lee, right? When you look at the evidence presented in the case, in a case of life, of murder, and life sentence, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot there. I think a lot of people have scratched their heads having listened to these reports in the Serial podcast and wondered, how do you get a conviction on such little evidence?
It's true, and as a criminal defense attorney, you're used to seeing cases where there's wiretaps, where there's videos, where there's all this evidence that comes in against your client.
Or DNA.
And DNA, and it's just not one of those cases. And one of the topics that came up last night in the panel discussion was Professor Colbert had actually gotten an opportunity to speak to some of the jurors after the first case, and there was discussion about the difference between Tina's abilities and her proficiency from the first case to the second trial that happened, because, of course, the first trial, there was a mistrial granted, and it ended prematurely, and then Adnan was tried a second time, and that second trial was where he was convicted and sentenced, that several of the jurors had told him afterwards that they didn't see a case. They were surprised that the case had been brought. They just didn't see a case that was there, and that's the way many of us saw it then and see it now.
Let's take some phone calls on this. Chris Floor, a defense attorney and with the Blackford and Floor firm. He's a partner in that, of course. And Justin George from the Baltimore Sun. Let's go to Pat in Baltimore. Go right ahead with your question, Pat.
Yes, I am wondering why Anand did not take the stand in his defense.
Why didn't he testify during the trial, do we know? And, as you know, that's not always recommended, is it?
No, it's probably one of those things that we'll never get to know, because usually it's a conversation with the lawyer. It's a good question, but I don't know that anyone has found anything in the files that have been reviewed about any real discussion between the two of them about why or why not. And certainly in this country, we do have the presumption of innocence, and the jury would have been instructed in Adnan's case, and I'm sure Judge Hurd did give that instruction, that they are not to not only not consider, but they may not even discuss the fact that a defendant does not testify in a case.
Justin?
Yeah, I don't know why, and certainly people should know that it's not unusual that he did not testify. It's happens all the time. I think one thing that Sarah sort of uncovered and that's kind of been told in Serial is that Adnan has trouble sort of figuring out where he was on that day. Doesn't really have explanations for exactly where he was, what he was doing. So maybe that was, you know, again, and, you know, he says that, why would I be able to remember? Nothing significant happened that day. I did not murder somebody. But, you know, when you sort of have that sort of argument, it might not be something you want to bring before.
This was a January day in 1999, right?
Okay.
Yeah. And I must say, from my own experience as a reporter, I think it's rare for a defendant in a murder trial to testify.
That's right.
Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
And what's also significant is that January 13th is when Heyman Lee disappeared, and where they believe that she was killed on that day. And there's some debate about that as well. But January 13th was the day, and then Adnan was not contacted and arrested in this case till 6 weeks later. So it's particularly hard for anyone to be able to retrace their steps on a day that was otherwise not particularly significant for such a long time. And what's also interesting about the podcast is that when the Innocence Project from the University of Virginia Law School came into the case and Deirdre Enright was interviewed, she said the innocent clients are the least helpful. And that's true. For those of us that have had, and I have had, innocent clients, they really are not particularly helpful. They don't know what to tell you.
Let's take another call here on the Midday Show, 410-662-8780. Try to get in as many calls as we can in the time that we have. AJ in Baltimore, go right ahead. Hi.
Hi, my name is AJ. I'm from Baltimore. I actually grew up near Woodlawn, and I went to the Islamic Society of Baltimore when I was younger, actually the same mosque as Adnan Syed. And a lot of people from our community have been listening. And most of them obviously feel that he's innocent, although I'm not sure either way. I don't know that anyone can ever know whether there's conclusive DNA evidence or not, if he was guilty or innocent. My specific question is about online forums. There's an online forum, Reddit, that hosted a lot of discussion on the Serial podcast. And how do you guys feel about people online who are generally not experts in the case trying to crack the case and, trying to find personal details about people's lives? It seemed like it was a pretty big deal. People's personal information, for example, Jay's grandmother's information was posted online where he lived. And it seems like it's a bad thing, but there's a lot of good that comes from people, many people trying to discuss and, comment on the case.
What do you think? You think he's guilty? You think he's innocent?
I don't know that. I personally don't know that we can ever know. And I think what's more important is it better for many guilty people to escape or one innocent person suffer? Whether he's guilty or innocent, should he be in jail based on the evidence presented? I don't think, based on the evidence that was presented, that he should be in jail. But I don't think it's possible to ever know whether he was guilty or innocent.
AJ has brought up, sort of an interesting thing. Serial, again, was just such a phenomenon that it just had, more attention from listeners and from fans than anything I've ever seen. And, I think it took a lot of criticism, unfair criticism, that it was sort of sensationalizing a real crime, that it was bringing attention to these, victims, who should have been left alone. I think, Heyman Lee's brother may have surfaced. We're not, completely sure it's him, but
you
think
said
it's
there's
him.
Been no contact with the family.
Right. Yeah. And just, apparently her brother did make one statement on Reddit that we believe that it's him. And he said, I can't believe all these people are sort of dissecting this. This is a real, true crime that happened. My mother, essentially kind of fell apart because of this. I can't believe all these people are sort of treating it like it's CSI. So that's an issue that, hadn't come up. Probably before. Here's Sarah, she's, using journalism, true journalism ethics in what she's doing, but then in the format that it was displayed and with the amount of fervor that was out there, it turned into sort of this entertainment thing that, went crazy on Reddit and a lot of places. And he brings up a really good discussion on, how you should view that.
Another call, this one from Aberdeen. Frank, go right ahead.
Yes, sir. I heard the entire series, and throughout the series, I kept on changing my mind. He did it. He didn't do it. Based on the series, I couldn't even, beyond a reasonable doubt, say he did it. And the two keys are Asia's testimony was so exact as to the weather conditions and everything else. And when the science was explained, I know that in my heart to be true. And the other, but the one thing that would ice it either way is Jay. Why would Jay, I don't know why, but we live in a city where, what's the thing you're about not snitching?
Yeah.
And if he had happened to have seen something wrong, and he had information he wanted to share it with the police, but he couldn't snitch. The police could have a way of manipulating his interrogation to point it at someone.
We want to talk about Jay Wilds for a moment, because he's the main witness, right, against Adnan.
Right.
What could we say about him?
Jay, again, you know, he has switched, you know, when he was interrogated, he was switched his sort of timeline of events, you know, multiple times. And even, you know, after Serial, he felt like he wanted to sort of, get his record out again or get what he wanted to say.
He gave some interviews.
And he gave another interview. Yeah. And what's odd is that he presented yet another sort of different timeline. So it just adds to the murkiness of this entire case. Now, during that that interview with The Intercept, the online magazine, he says, again, yes, that, you know, I don't snitch. This is Baltimore. I wasn't going to do that. That's a reason. He says he only presented enough, you know, evidence, or essentially the questions that he was asked, he only gave a pointed answer to and left a lot of things out. He said, you know, he wasn't going to help the prosecution. He was going to do this. That's what he sort of said. And in laying out his whole new timeline, he said that, you know, essentially that prosecutors sort of put things together, or made it appear that prosecutors put things together and didn't really either didn't ask him all the things, or he sort of switched again. I don't know.
In that interview, he also said the reason he helped Adnan with the body was because he didn't want to be found to be he didn't want Adnan snitching to the police about his marijuana sales.
Right.
Right. We should take another call here. Chris, did you want to add something to that on Jay Wilds?
That's the thing that always comes up, is that what about Jay? And it came up in the panel last night. And I think that when you're evaluating people's credibility, and it was so wonderful to hear those actual tapes be played on the podcast, because I think anybody that listens to those tapes has to start thinking, with all the changes in the stories, the way he starts out and so forth, is this somebody that I would make a judgment on about something that would be important in my life? That's what the beyond a reasonable doubt and the burden of proof instructions that are given to the court talk about, is whether you would, in evaluating these witnesses and this evidence, make an important decision in your own life based on. And I think that it's really hard for anybody to say that they would. There's just too much changes and too much motive, because he was a drug dealer at the time. He was interviewed with the police. He was admitting at some point that he was dusting off fingerprints from shovels after he buries a body. Gets in a lot of trouble.
410-662-8780, our number. David in Baltimore, we'll go to you next.
Hey, so from the podcast, I think I could equivocally state that the prosecutor's time of events is not accurate. So the big question keeps going, did he do it? I was like, I don't know. But I know this much. It didn't happen when the prosecutor said it did. And the other fact is that Jay's story, or stories, I don't think any one singular story is even plausible or possible. So I guess at the end of the day, my question is, with these discrepancies, how does this case, you know, what are his chances to really get a fair trial?
Well, the appeal, actually, this appeal before the Court of Special Appeals doesn't really turn on that. It's a different argument.
Right.
It's incompetent counsel.
The
right?
Two issues are whether the attorney, Ms. Gutierrez, had communicated or sought out a plea offer for him that he had asked her to do, and the issue of the Asia McClain. But that's a step towards being able to get back in court. And it's frustrating for people, and it's a common thing that lawyers get criticized for, is like, why does this take so long? And certainly, as I've been a big proponent of restorative justice, to think that this trial and this awful situation where these people, Heyman's family, lost this loved one, and that their daughter's diary would be read out in court as evidence in trying to resolve it, I think these are things that we need to take a look at the bigger picture and see, how do we want to reform our criminal justice system? And that's the beauty of having the light shined upon it. But in this particular case, I really do think that that it's been beneficial to have people looking at it more closely.
A note here from Susan in Bel Air. She says, as a big fan of Serial, I follow the show closely, and I am in the evidence does not support a finding of guilty beyond a reasonable doubt camp. But I am concerned that Serial glossed over issues of domestic violence regarding both Adnan and Jay. Like so many other murdered women, Heyman was killed by an acquaintance or an ex, if either theory of this case is to be believed. Are you aware of any of the allegations regarding stalking or other abusive behaviors by either Adnan or Jay toward Heyman? And if so, was it wise for Serial to ignore that angle? Was that angle pursued at all?
I think that's a really important question, and that is that one of the reasons why those of us that felt so strongly about Adnan's innocence and still do is that as his friends and Saad, who was his best friend who was on that panel last night, explained, this was not the situation of somebody that was distraught over the loss of his girlfriend and didn't you just couldn't go on with it. There was no history of peace orders or protective orders or stalking or anything of that nature. I think the closest that Sarah ever came to bringing out that issue was saying that there was some letter written to Adnan by Hay saying that she was concerned that, you know, that it was time to move on. But having seen many, many of these cases, and it's a very, very important issue, the issue of domestic violence, those facts just weren't here in this case.
There's a tweet here from John who wants a comment on this. He says, I wish panelists would talk about how jurors said they presumed his guilt because he refused to testify. Do we know that were jurors interviewed and did jurors say that?
You know, I think one person did. You know, I can't remember where that came out. I think it might have been speaking with Sarah, but I think one juror did.
Judges often, well, that's part of judges' instruction, is it not to presume anything from the defendant's choice not to testify?
Right. And as the other caller who called in about that question, it is a very difficult thing for folks to wrap their head around, because a very common situation is jurors put themselves in the role of the person who's accused and say, well, I'd be shouting from the rooftops that I didn't do this. And that's been a criticism of Adnan as well. And it's one of those cases where you're between the rock and a hard place as a criminal defense lawyer. If your client protests his innocence too much, you get the Shakespearean, he doth protest too much. Right. And then if he's quiet, then he doesn't protest enough.
I see the dilemma there. Farouk, we'll take your call next. Farouk, thanks for calling Midday.
Hi, Dan. This is Farouk Marfani. Yes.
Yes. What did you want to say, Farouk?
Okay. I know Adnan when I came to this country in 1984. I'm just saying that I know Adnan since I came to this country in 1984.
We heard you. Yeah.
Right. Because the radio was on, so it doesn't look like a duplication. That's why I turned my radio off. And I'm 200% sure this guy cannot do this kind of crime, period. I think he was trapped because of this some kind of a drug thing. Somebody else killed, and this trapped this guy because this was his girlfriend, you know. And he lives only two blocks from a house. And plus, this Christine Gutierrez. You know, she did not do her job, okay? And that's what happened. And at that time, all the media was against this boy. You know, we went to the bail hearing, everything was against. At that time, the one boy from Israel, he killed somebody he was trying to escape from the country. And that's why saying that, oh, don't bail him out, otherwise he's going to go out of country.
All right, Farouk, I'm sorry we're short of time there, but thank you for your comment. Someone who knew Adnan Syed. So the timeline and what happens now, Justin, just go over that for folks who are interested. We have the Court of Special Appeals ruling opening the case, so there'll be a hearing, a filing, and then a hearing sometime. What's the timeline on that?
Yeah, there'll be a filing by Adnan's attorney, Justin Brown, by March 16th. Essentially, it's going to lay out his entire case for the appeal and why he believes that Adnan deserves a new trial. Then April 16th is when the Maryland Attorney General's office has to respond to whatever arguments that have been laid out. And then in June, the Court of Special Appeals will hear oral arguments where they can decide either to order a new trial, deny Adnan's request, period, or possibly remand or take, you know, send the case back to circuit court for more evidentiary hearings. Maybe they want to hear Asia McClain testify and then sort of take up that appeal issue again.
Anything to add to that, Chris?
Yeah, I just want to add real quick. This isn't an issue that's come up on the questions, but I have heard people talk about it, and the podcast really didn't do this issue justice. The second issue that Justin has raised is about whether Adnan was his lawyer, Tina Gutierrez, pursued a guilty plea, and that was something that he requested. And folks that, you know, are very convinced that he is innocent or at least feel that there wasn't proof beyond a reasonable doubt say, why on earth would this guy pursue a guilty plea if he's been maintained his innocence the whole way through? And that shows a lack of appreciation of the system, and that is that you can enter a guilty plea but not admit to the crime. And you can seek out what's called an Alford plea or a nolo contendere plea, where you're saying and exactly why Mr. Alford in the Supreme Court case that was decided there, he was facing the death penalty. And he said, I don't want to go to face the death penalty, even though I'm saying I didn't do this. I would rather have a sentence that I can live. And in this particular case, with the ultimate result being a life plus 30, it makes perfectly good sense that he would have said, hey, see if there's anything you could get from me. Right. And it's not an issue about there's some talk about that the state's attorney wasn't going to give an offer and so forth, but it's the process.
The Alford plea, meaning I admit that you probably have enough evidence to get a conviction out of me.
Right. You have to admit that there was enough evidence to be able to convince a jury at trial, but that you're not admitting that you did it.
Right. Chris Floor, who was one of the original attorneys for Adnan Syed way back when in 1999, has stayed with this case and obviously knows a lot about it. So thank you very much for being here and for
Pleasure.
Your perspectives on this. It's very interesting. And I also want to thank Justin George from the Baltimore Sun for being here to fill us in on this, and we'll talk about it again.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Justin. We'll take a break here on Midday Friday. When we come back, a couple things to tell you about. First of all, Paula Gallagher from the Baltimore County Library has got some book recommendations for us. We're also going to tell you about a play, very interesting play called Zero Hour, Tokyo Rose's Last Tape, that's at Towson University tonight, right? Yeah, it's tonight. Short break on Midday Friday. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday Friday. Turn now to a play that's being performed tonight at Towson University. It's called Zero Hour, Tokyo Rose's Last Tape. And it tells the story of the English-speaking radio announcers who were forced by the Japanese government during World War II to perform propaganda to weaken the morale of Allied soldiers. The Americans eventually branded the announcers, all of them, with the name Tokyo Rose. Here with us now to tell us more about the play and about the story behind it is Towson University history professor Stephen Phillips. Nice to have you on the show with
Thank
us, Professor
much.
Phillips. And also is Japanese actress Hinoko Arao, the star of the show. Nice to have you with us, too.
Thank you.
I grew up hearing about Tokyo Rose, and it wasn't just a legend. It actually happened, Steve Phillips.
Yeah, it was, but it was a series of women who were broadcasting on what was called the Zero Hour on Radio Tokyo to try to harm the morale of soldiers in the Pacific. After the war, the media decided to focus on one woman as being the Tokyo Rose. She made a horrible mistake. She was given $2,000 by Cosmopolitan magazine for an exclusive interview where she said, I am the Tokyo Rose.
The Tokyo Rose.
After that, eventually people like Walter Winchell and others ran with the idea of this siren who was, a traitor. And that helped get her brought back to the United States and convicted of treason in 1949.
Hinoko, what is it like to play this part? Can you tell us a little bit about your performance in the play? What happens in the play?
My character is based on the on Aiva Toguri, the woman that he talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, as somebody who grew up in Japan, we originally didn't know much about the history of Japanese Americans. So, it was a great way for me to learn about history and feel something about what happened to this group of people, because learning about history is one thing, but as actors, we have to feel something about the incident.
And so what do you feel about her?
It's really sad, because she was the one who didn't change the nationality, and the majority of women who worked as typists changed the nationality because of the pressure from the Japanese government.
So the one you're referring to was actually American born.
She is an all American
success
story.
That's why Winchell said that she was a traitor.
Right. Remember, treason requires that you have U.S. citizenship and never renounce. She's an all American success story. Went to UCLA and studied zoology. Went back to Japan, not to support Japan. Went back to care for a sick relative and was trying to come back to the U.S. when Pearl Harbor occurred. She never denounced the U.S. or renounced her citizenship, but because American media at the end of the war decided to fixate on one person as this kind of evil temptress, she sort of bore all the blame.
So, Hinoko Arao, this is a touring company. So you were in New York already, performed Zero Hour.
Mm-hmm. And then D.C. and here, and we are going to Toronto and then L.A.
Could you describe for the audience, our listeners, what it looks like. It sounds like a really interesting set for the play.
Yeah,
the way
it's really
performed.
Visually
yeah.
stunning because it's designed like this is directed by Miwa Yanagi and written by Miwa Yanagi, and then the stage set is like done by Miwa Yanagi as well, and she's like an amazing visual artist. So it's like visually really enjoyable, I think.
And there are several women in the cast.
Yes.
Right.
And we all dress up the same.
We're gonna hear what Tokyo Rose might have sounded like, or at least the Tokyo Rose as portrayed in Zero Hour, Tokyo Rose's last tape, which is being performed tonight at Towson University. Let's listen to this.
Good evening, my fellow orphans in the Pacific. Your boat must have been spared if you're listening to me today. What a great relief. But this might be the last night you'll be hearing my voice if you keep fighting this silly war.
This silly war. What is that from, Steve?
That's from Zero Hour.
That's from the play.
Yes, but it's okay. Also they're taking some of that from the act. The Americans, remember, were taping all of this, recording all of it during the war. And the ironic thing here is the propaganda was laughable. There's no evidence that any American behavior was changed because of it. They liked the music she played because she played popular hits.
That's how she got them hooked.
And she and others were so bad at the propaganda, most Americans found it laughable. Even the U.S. military.
One last thing about this. It seems to me that I saw a movie somewhere along the way, American movie about World War II, where the voice of Tokyo Rose is almost a constant soundtrack. Right. Well, not constantly, but several times during the movie. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
Pearl Harbor?
Was it in Pearl Harbor?
It was in Pearl Harbor, yeah. a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
This might have been before this. I'm thinking black and white. But it's an old movie, and you kept hearing her voice. But anyway, let me tell folks about this performance. It's just tonight. One time only, right?
Yes.
One time only. It's at Towson University tonight in Stevens Hall Theater at 7:30 p.m. We'll put some information about it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Ticket information available. Again, it's the story of Tokyo Rose called Zero Hour, Tokyo Rose's last tape. And thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Yeah, break a leg. Good luck. I mean, break a leg. I don't mean good luck. Right. Thank you very much. And
thank
Professor
you.
Phillips, too. Paula Gallagher is here joining us from Baltimore County. Nice to see you again, Paula.
Nice to see you, too, Dan.
So Paula blogs about books. She loves books. Of course, she's a librarian with Baltimore County's Pikesville branch and joins us from time to time to recommend books. And this time you're going to recommend books of short stories, right?
Yes, exactly, Dan. February has been an excellent month for short stories. There are just numerous collections that have come out. I'd like to talk about three today.
Okay.
They're long anticipated. I want to start with the more realistic of the collections, and that's an author by the name of Charles Baxter. And he's got a collection called There's Something I Want You to Do. And if you're not familiar with him, know that they're very slice-of-life stories. This particular collection are some interrelated stories. He really takes a look at the contemporary human condition. These stories are set in Minnesota, and they're interrelated, some by character and some by theme. But, you know, one of the notable stories in it, there's a man who his ex-wife has returned out of nowhere. She had left many years previous, left him with an infant son. She shows up and he describes her as looking as if she had gone through the car wash and then dried. He's remarried to her best friend, who was the one who encouraged her to leave in the first place.
Oh, that sounds good. And how many stories are in that book? It doesn't matter.
It's 10 stories,
right,
but still a fairly...
That's a good number.
Fairly slim volume.
I happen to like collections of short stories. I don't know if you knew that, but you're just saying...
I did not.
You like short stories?
I do, quite a bit.
Yeah. We spend a lot of time talking about novels, but the short story, I think, is a wonderful thing.
There's a lot...
maybe my favorite form of literature.
That's great. There's a lot to recommend them, and I find, unfortunately, many of my customers don't like them. They like to commit to a longer story. Yeah. They get frustrated when they like the character and the situation, and it's gone in just a few pages.
Charles Baxter, There's Something I Want You to Do. That's the first collection Paula mentioned. And what do you have next?
Next, I'll segue into Neil Gaiman. And he's a British writer who lives in the United States now. He's kind of got a rock star status.
Hmm.
But his new collection is called Trigger Warning, and it's short fictions and disturbances. So it includes a little bit of poetry. But Neil Gaiman, if you haven't read him, he blends reality and fantasy. It's a way that he's lulling you. He's making you very comfortable. And then all of a sudden the story will become kind of unsettling and dark. He works in realistic fiction with some twists and some fantasy, and then he'll do some stories that are just fantasy outright. One of the stories in this book that I found most intriguing is about a young man who's about 30, and his friends start to tell him that they're seeing his old girlfriend around town. And he feels a little bit startled because he wants to know who that is. And they say, oh, Cassandra, you remember you used to write her name on your notebook constantly in high school. And he thinks about it, and he's just chilled because he realizes he made her up. She was never a real person.
Ooh.
But they assure him that he doesn't tell his friends that, but they assure him they've met this young woman. She still looks great, and she's brightened up when they talked about him.
Ooh, I like that.
Yes.
It sort of steps off into the Stephen King area someplace, right?
Kind of a little bit.
A girl he fantasized about. And
yes.
Now his friends see her around town.
Exactly.
Boy,
and
I like
he made her up because, pressure from his mother and his friends, and she exists.
Neil Gaiman, G-A-I-M-A-N.
Correct.
Trigger warning. Short fictions and disturbances.
Yes.
Very good. And you've got a third one for us. Also, another collection of short stories.
Another.
Is it unusual to see collections of short stories, three in a month?
Actually, in February, I can think of two or three others that have come out. So, it is unusual. And especially these authors. The last one I wanted to talk about is Kelly Link. And she's an author. Her collections are an event. She hasn't written for adults or collected for adults in almost 10 years. And her collection now is called Get in Trouble. And it's very hard to characterize Kelly Link other than to say that she's a magical realist. And you're reading a story that you feel, is realistic. The introductory story in the collection is called The Summer People. And it's a teenage girl who's home from school. She's sick. You can tell that she and her father live a very hardscrabble existence, but it's contemporary modern day. But then you start getting let in on some other things that tell you that this is a fantasy story. The summer people, she's in charge of providing the provisions for the people who come in to stay in the homes that her father is managing. But one of them is very different from the others, and the summer people are creative and magical, and she's actually bound to them. She can't leave because of them, so she's stuck in this dead-end town.
Magical realism, and it sounds to me like with Neil Gaiman, you have, reality, the stepping into the supernatural a little bit in both of these?
Yeah, and Kelly Link does some of the same things. Neil Gaiman has referred to her as a national treasure. They're fans of each other. But she's not afraid of twists and turns, and she never explains what's going on. She really leaves the reader to puzzle things out for themselves.
I'm glad you mentioned this, because as I said, I really do like short stories. But people who use the public library, in your experience, the ones who enjoy fiction the most want the longer form novels, prefer those over short stories?
Well, not to make a generalization, it happens a lot at the branch that I work at.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly these authors have numerous fans. And anybody who's interested in trying these, the nice thing is we have them in multiple formats through the library. So if you want to get them as an ebook, we have them that way. If you want to listen to them on a drive, we have them as audiobooks, e-audiobooks too, depending on the book. And these will all be listed on the blog Between the Covers, bcpl.info. And you'll be able to click on me and read about these books and order them if you're interested.
Does the library get really busy on a cold weekend?
It was interesting. It was quite quiet today, Dan. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the reason was.
What usually happens? I mean, when you're going to be booked up for the weekend or closed in for the weekend, it's cold.
If they call for snow, people come in droves.
Okay. Well, no. She just mentioned snow. That doesn't mean it's happening, right, Paula? Don't want to alarm anybody.
I'm hoping not, no.
Okay. Paula Gallagher, again, thank you very much for being here, Paula.
Thanks, Dan.
Paula is a librarian with Baltimore County's Pikesville branch, and she writes about books for the library's blog, Between the Covers. And again, if you want information about the play tonight at Towson University, you should go to events.towson.edu. Oh, or you can also go to tuboxoffice.com. Well, thank you very much, Hinoko. Thank you very much. And here's a phone number for tickets, 410-704-2787. So anyway, thank you all for being here today. Thank you. We'll take a break here. That's our first hour of Midday. We got another hour coming up, Midday Eats. John Shields, Henry Hong, and Nancy Longo from Pierpoint Restaurant are going to join us in the second hour of the show in just a few minutes. But right now, we'll take a break for lunch. We have pizza today provided by Joe Squared Pizza. Joe Squared, located at 133 West North Avenue in the Station North neighborhood, at the Inner Harbor at Power Plant Live. And you can find them on the web at joesquared.com. Please stay tuned for the news, and then stick around for the second hour of our show, please.